Is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we welcome back Emmy-winning composer David Wakelin. We're going to talk music and books and movies and all kinds of wonderful things. Here's David. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Sherry. It's a wonderful time to be here, and I'm so glad that you invited me.
I'm so glad to have you back. It's been a while.
Yes, and hello to people who are listening live or who are listening sometime in the future or anywhere in the world. We love you all.
Yes, very much. And everybody should be happy and healthy and all that good stuff. It's not New Year's, but we're just trying to wish everybody well.
Wish everybody well all the time because that's what we do.
That's right. So how are you doing? How's your weather and all that stuff?
I'm doing great, thank you. The weather here is sunny with some clouds, which is great. I'm a California kid who loves the weather. I love rain and snow, and I love sunshine and wind. It's all good for me.
Yeah. It's in the 60s. It's okay. I prefer it in the 70s, but that's me.
Well, we have heaters and air conditioners, so you can make your environment the way you like it.
That's true. Very true.
Although, I guess we have to be careful to not overdo it. We want to...
Yeah. We don't want any brownouts or whatever they call it.
Yes, we haven't had any of those this year. And that's good.
Yeah, they usually it's during the height of winter and the height of summer that's when they start doing that stuff. Because everybody's using their heaters and their air conditioners.
Yeah, sometimes they write music for weather. And I did that even before I was doing documentaries. You know, I work on different kinds of films, including nature documentaries. So if there's a storm or there's a desert or something, then you kind of play the weather, you play the atmosphere. But I did that even before I did movies and TV and games. I like to do rainy music and sunny music and just play the weather.
Was it Mel Torme? I think it was Mel Torme who wrote his Christmas song. And the reason he wrote it was because they were having a heat wave and he wanted to cool off. So he's thinking of all the stuff about Christmas.
Yes.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Yes. His title is The Christmas Song. And the way Mel put it, and I heard him say this, was... The Christmas Song was an exercise in being cool by thinking cool.
Mm-hmm. I kind of really love that's how he came up with that. Because it's actually one of my favorite songs.
Yes. And, you know, it's also kind of like a very hip thing to say that, you know, if you want to be a cool person, you got to think cool first.
Yeah, you gotta be cool in all the different ways to be cool. I think he was a very interesting man. I love that he sort of had a resurgence because of Night Court. Because Harry Anderson, I think that was his name, who played the judge in Night Court, in real life and in the show, loves Mel Torme. He's had a big poster of him in his office. And because of that, he actually had a resurgence in his career. Did you know that?
Yes. Appearing, either your work or yourself, on a TV show or in a video game or in a movie, those things can transform somebody's career, right? It's a phenomena that really is related to promotion, that you know, people know things that get promotion. And promotion often is very expensive, but if somebody puts your song in a movie or a TV show, they're literally giving you millions of dollars worth of free promotion, and that makes a big difference.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because of so many, you know, they were making fun of Barry Manilow in Murphy Brown, and it actually made his sales go through the skylight because Murphy was a big hit. because her son loved Barry, and so he came to sing at his birthday party or something, and they said all of a sudden his record for that time went even higher than normal, which he always was. He always had big hits. But I just think that how something that's kind of silly and funny can really, really help another entertainer. It's really kind of cool if you think about it. It's nice.
Yes. Well, just a few months ago, Running Up That Hill went to number one and had a billion, with a B, views and listens because the Kate Bush song from 37 years ago was placed in Stranger Things. It had never been a hit song in 37 years. You know, when it came out, it was kind of okay.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was placed in Stranger Things, millions of people heard it, and it just blew the roof off the charts. And that just shows that, you know, the power of television. And Nora Felder, who was the still is the music supervisor for Stranger Things, has a great knack for finding songs that fit the show, and it can change people's lives. Also, in the last few months, Weird Al, who's one of my favorite comedians of all time, he won two Emmy Awards for his entirely fictional a parody of himself, biography. So he became he's always been popular at a certain level, but he became even more popular just because he got the money to make a movie about himself. And the movie was like his song. It wasn't the real Weird Al's life. He was making a satire of his own life.
That's sort of like what they did with Elvira, the Cassandra Peters, the character she played when she was the horror movie queen. But music and her silliness, she always had these really great old tunes. Even something silly like Monster Mash all of a sudden went through the roof because it was on her show.
Yes, so that really makes a difference.
Yeah. And
yet, the people who write the underscore, the wonderful film composers of the world, are almost all obscure. There's only a tiny handful of film composers that are known. So it's kind of funny that way, that the people who write the underscore that is in virtually every movie and TV show from beginning to end, those people are usually not very well known. But, you know, if you put a song in there, yes. So, I don't know, I guess that means you got to write songs. And I do write songs. I love writing songs, but I like writing songs for a particular occasion. Makes sense.
So what? Okay, this is going to be a strange question. What about when, like a movie, like Pretty Woman, uses a song from somebody who passed on.
Yeah.
And it makes it really popular again. Does the family benefit from that as a composer?
As long as it's still copywritten, which means that in the United States that it's within 70 years of the death of the person that wrote it, then their heirs or successors, which are often publishing companies, but sometimes, usually it's a combination of their family, their heirs, and the publishing company get the royalties from that.
I can't remember his name, is that sad?
That can amount to tens of millions of dollars, huge, you know, fortune. And there are members of ASCAP and BMI, those are the performing rights organizations that exist to help composers and songwriters collect the royalties from all the different entities that are using music. They have members who are not musicians and who aren't in the music industry, except they're the heir of a famous musician.
That's interesting.
And I've met them, you know. And it's very interesting how, you know, to them, it's kind of like this money machine.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their own life, that they're living their life, and then they have their father or their uncle or their grandfather or their mother's copyrights that are constantly generating money for them.
Mm-hmm. I remembered his name, Roy Orbison, right?
Yes, Roy Orbison. He was a very successful pioneer of rock and roll.
He wrote Pretty Woman.
Yes, he wrote Pretty Woman.
Yeah. I couldn't remember his name and
long
popped into my head.
Before the movie came out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he passed away before the movie came out, so he had to have written it before it came out.
Yes, and that's an interesting thing, that there's music of the time, and there's timeless music.
Mm-hmm.
And most songs are music of the time. And no matter how successful they are and how many people love them, they tend to fade away in kind of a parabola that kind of, you know, just inevitably goes down over a period of 10 or 20 years. But then there's timeless music where it just kind of stays around. And that would be something like, say, the Beatles, where the Beatles haven't been around for over 50 years, but their songs are still around. And that's very unusual, but it does happen.
Oh, yeah.
And there's examples of, you know, like Edgar Allan Poe. He's a good example for writers.
Mm-hmm.
He was a struggling writer his whole life, and he never really found success until decades after he was gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like
adapting his stuff. You know, centuries later, they're still adapting his stuff because he wrote timeless art. It just didn't happen to be timeless art of his time. He was ahead of his time, so, you know, and there are people who can do both. You know, there's people who write stuff that is successful for a while, and then they write stuff that doesn't catch on until much later. And all those different combinations can happen. We can talk about movies. Wizard of Oz. When The Wizard of Oz came out, it did okay. It wasn't a flop. It wasn't a hit. It just did okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then 20 years later, it got licensed to television as part of a kind of a package deal. You
and
know,
it ran every single year of my childhood.
Yeah. And then it caught on like it was the heart and soul of Christmas or you know, whatever holiday that it was played around, like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. And suddenly the whole world saw what a wonderful thing it was.
Mm.
It took 20 years for that to happen, plus TV.
yeah, that's true. TV was around, like, in the 20s. It just didn't become it wouldn't become everywhere until like the 50s.
Yes. Well, that was a technical thing. You know, TV is constantly technically evolving. And when people talk about who invented television, I just have to, you know, kind of hold my tongue, and because once you know the history of television, you know that it was a collective effort. It wasn't any one person. And the more you know about it, the more it becomes clear that this person made that invention and that person made this invention. And each of them got it closer and closer. And then there was, you know, the economic situation, and all of those factors kind of had to come together very gradually over decades. And then TV became a hit.
Well, so, it's just like, Betty White was on a TV show in 1939 with Bob Hope, and it just broadcast in that area, and the only people who saw it were the people that were in that studio.
Yes.
That was one of the first broadcasts that famous people were on. Although she was not famous yet. She was right out of high school. But
well, you know, Betty White is a perfect example of someone who was born to do a certain thing.
Yeah.
He was born to be a TV star. And that was before people even knew what TV was. But she was a perfect match for it. And her career just went on and on and on. And she kept winning awards. And she kept going on to different kinds of shows. She just was made for TV, and TV was made for her. And there was really never a time that she was off of TV.
That's true.
So,
I mean, she was, even when she wasn't doing a TV show, she was doing game shows, which is how she met her husband.
Yes, well, you know, game shows can kind of go in and out of style, but they have always been there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, someone who's a great match for TV, all right, they're not casting me in any dramas or comedies, so I'll just move over to game shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is about Betty that's really interesting is that she could sing, she could dance, she could act. She actually directed a talk show that she did, the first Betty White show. She produced
it. She was prolific with that. I mean, she was on the air like every day.
Every day, 7 days a week. That's amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine that now. Well, you know, I guess there are like comedians like, you know, Tonight Show hosts, they're on every day and that sort of thing. But it's very rare that you find someone who's such a perfect match for the medium.
And the thing is that when she got her first sitcom, which was based on a skit from her TV show called Life with Elizabeth, and they said, well, it's going to be on every week. Will you be able to handle that? And she goes, gee, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself with my time, considering that I worked every single day for the last 3 years. I mean, that's Betty.
Yes, well, you know, that's a very sweet and humorous way of telling them, I've got this covered. You don't have to worry.
Exactly. She goes, I think I can handle it. But yeah, she was amazing. I got to work with her once.
How cool is that?
Yeah, I was in an episode of Golden Girls about homeless people, and I played a mother of a homeless girl. And I got to shoot a scene with all three of them. It was really the highlight of my very short acting career.
Well, that's an amazing highlight, though. I mean, you got to work with somebody who's got a statue in front of the Television Academy.
Yep. Yeah, she was so sweet. I remember we were on a break, And I walked over to her and I said, "Miss White, I gotta tell you, when I was in high school, you and Doris Day inspired me to start an Actors and Others for Animals at my school." And she jumped up and she hugged me and she said, "Oh my dear, that's so wonderful." And she was, that was the best moment of my whole life.
Well, that's so beautiful. Well, congratulations. That was a good thing that you did to start the program, and it was a good thing that you told her.
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was wonderful. Well, I've always been in it for animals, so not surprising.
I worked on a documentary about the Gentle Barn. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's an animal shelter for pets and farm animals that need a home. And it's just a beautiful place, and they do tours of it. So, you know, the animals have a safe place where they're free roaming, and they have, you know, their own natural kind of food. And they bring children and seniors to visit there, and it's kind of a healing experience for the humans, because seeing the happy animals kind of helps bring out the joy and heal the hurt in the humans. And I really love doing that documentary, Gentle Barn.
That's interesting. I think there's hospital programs, because I remember when my father was in the hospital, they brought a kitty and a dog and a bird and all these things for my dad to pet and play with when he was very, very ill. Because there's a healing thing about any animal. But yeah, that was a program at the hospital my dad was at. I assume that's other places in the country.
Well, the Gentle Barn has expanded too. You know, I think it started here in L.A., but they now have branches all over the country. And I don't know why I'm bringing that up. That was a while ago. You know, it's like I want to be sure we talk about Gallifrey One, the Doctor Who convention, and some of the songs that I've done. I want to be sure people hear about those, because I want to share them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually, I was going to ask you before we talk about that. First of all, I want to thank you for writing the music for our radio play, Cyrano. And I wanted to ask you, did you like it? Did you like our performance?
Oh, I loved your performance, and I loved Charlie as Cyrano. He was just outstanding.
Yeah, yeah, he's
just
great.
You know, charming and funny and intelligent, really good. And the adaptation was good, too, because, it's still online. People heard it live, but you could also still hear it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's there forever. Yeah, the person who adapted it was Everett Robert.
Yes, and I remember working with Everett, and he was a good guy, and he was wise in directing music. He let the music speak in the way that it naturally helped the show, instead of, see, some people try and make the music be what they want it to be, and that rarely works out very well. That usually gets you things that are serviceable and utilitarian, and they get the job done. But they rarely sparkle, because the music is laboring under the restrictions that the person put on it, instead of letting it do what it needs to do to help the story. Not to say that music that's over-directed can't help the story, because it can. It's just not helping it as much as it could.
Mm-hmm.
Not letting the show be all that it can be.
Can you tell us a little bit about creating the music for Cyrano?
Yes, thanks for asking. It's wonderful to have a subject that's so iconic and beloved around the world as the story of Cyrano de Bergerac, the poet swordsman with the large proboscis. And he is such an iconic character that creating a theme for him was definitely inspiring. And the original Cyrano is actually written during the Victorian era, relatively recent. And it tends to be productions Cyrano set in that era in France that are the ones you see the most often. But this one that that you and Everett worked on had a really clever idea of setting it during the revolutionary period in America. So I tried to create something that was true to the Victorian era at its core, but on the surface, instead of using just French music, and there is a little bit of French music in there, I used music inspirations from the Revolutionary War period. So I got to go back to American history and folk songs and pop songs of the era, and you know, Mozart was alive at that time, and I put in all kinds of elements of music flourishes and orchestrations, like for example, the harpsichord was a very popular instrument at that time. The piano was just coming into play. So if we were going to do it in the Victorian era, like the original, I would have used piano, but instead we used harpsichord, and I thought that it fit wonderfully with Cyrano, because his character works in different time periods. You know, there's been movies where Cyrano is set in modern-day America, so the character works in all those different eras. So if you listen to the music, hopefully you'll hear something that's French and something that's American and something that's Cyrano.
And the way he was so ironic and funny, like when he tells these two fools about how he went to the moon. I mean, that could be any time period. That, I mean, it was. Even though it was written in the Victorian period, it was a very modern play in some ways.
Yes, very forward-looking. And there's definitely humor in there. And even in the love theme, I tried to put just a touch of romantic comedy in there. So, because you have to be able to laugh at a comedy, right?
Yeah. I mean, we hope that people laughed when they listen to it. Because that's the point. It's a comedy.
Yes, and that's one of the things that I learned working on a movie a while back. That's kind of the first thing you have to do in a comedy, especially as a composer, is you have to let the audience understand right away that it's okay to laugh.
Mm-hmm. Because you're going to make the people who are doing it very upset if you don't.
Yeah. Well, comedies are actually funny, pun intended that way. With a drama, it's usually clear, even after you've worked on it for quite a while, trying to get it right, that it's dramatic or it's not dramatic. But with comedy, after you've worked with it for a while, it becomes very tricky to tell if it's still funny or not. So comedy, you kind of have to know how to do comedy well enough that even though you're not sure that it's funny, you're doing things that are funny, and then you need a test audience to make sure that it's funny.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's one of the reasons that Cyrano is still with us, is because it's timeless.
Yes, it's timeless art. There's art of the time and timeless art, and they're both important, and they're both necessary. They're usually not the same thing, though. For example, the number one song on the pop charts, you know, on Billboard this week, is probably not going to be popular in a century. It's probably going to be music of our time. And a song that was written in 1924, well, you know, something by George Gershwin,
mm-hmm.
that's probably going to still be popular today. So those are different things.
Gershwin, Porter, Berlin, they're going to be forever.
Yes. And sometimes their big hits back in the day are popular still, and sometimes it's lesser known songs that at that time that are now more popular. Let's start with hearing the theme from Cyrano.
It's so beautiful.
Thank you. I tried to make it beautiful with just a touch of whimsy or humor in it.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful and it's fun. It's interesting you can do that with music. It's not everything you can have beautiful and fun at the same time.
Yes. Well, that's a combination of talent, craftsmanship, and inspiration.
Okay, I can take that. You were mentioning the Doctor Who convention?
Yes, I was invited by my friend Craig Miller and my friend Sean at Gallifrey One to go to that storied convention, the Doctor Who convention that meets here in Los Angeles once a year, and it's just the most wonderful, well-run, ideal place to hang out with fans and learn interesting, wonderful things. All the fans are smart and friendly, and they're genuinely interested in whoever they have as a guest to talk about the show, and the people that are there, the actors and the composers and the writers, all the people that they have from the show, they're all intelligent and nice and friendly people that are great to hang out with. It's one of the most wonderful conventions, and I got to be on a panel with Dominic, who is the composer for Doctor Who back in the 80s, and Sagan, who is the composer for the new Doctor Who that's coming out on Disney Plus. So we really spanned the eras, and it was just fun talking about film music and Doctor Who music, and you know, we talked about Delia Derbyshire, who is one of my favorite composers because she was a pioneer. There had been electronic music in movies starting back in the 1930s, perhaps even a little bit earlier. But Doctor Who was the first show that had an electronic theme song.
Mm-hmm.
And Delia's orchestration of Ron Granger's theme was so innovative and brilliant that when she played it for Ron, he said, "Did I write that?" Because arrangements can be transformative. And we're talking about both pop songs and classical themes. The arranger, the person who takes the basic musical idea and elaborates it into a new form with new sounds, it can really make all the difference. And she took a simple theme and turned it into the iconic Doctor Who theme.
Mm-hmm.
And she did it using electronics, which back in 1963 was no mean feat. That was quite an accomplishment to make something that was so catchy and musical with the very basic tools that they had.
And now it's used all over the place. I mean, it's used in Midsummer Murders and all different kinds of stuff.
Yes, and I'm sure that Star Trek was influenced by that Doctor Who theme, because Star Trek makes very, you know, the original series,
mm-hmm.
a creative use of musical electronics, and that was very unusual at that time.
I can still hear the whoosh.
Yes. Well, the whoosh is actually Alexander Courage going whoosh. And then processing that sound, which is very forward-looking, because that's something that we still do today, where we record a sound that's kind of interesting, and then we do electronic processing to make it the sound that we want. I was just recently looking at Ansel Adams' work again, and what a giant of art. He was the guy who put photography on the map by mm-hmm. showing that it could be an art form, because he would take a photo and then he would process it until it became a work of art that expressed something that he wanted to express that was not there in the image but was latent, it had the potential to be that. And that's kind of what that whoosh is in Star Trek, that he made a whooshing sound and then it was processed so it sounded like a sci-fi spaceship.
Yep. And show the credits.
that's a great theme song. And he also made really great use of electronics as a solo instrument. So like in the first episode of Star Trek, a lot of it is orchestral, and he's a brilliant orchestrator and, you know, used traditional orchestra. But for certain really sci-fi cosmic moments, he would let electronics carry the story. And I'm sure that that was inspired by Delia Derbyshire's theme song, because that showed that you could set up the whole show using electronics.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Doctor Who, it's really interesting because it was a children's show and it just affected everything in every market as a science fiction. It just, it exploded.
Well, you know, it's kind of like a great children's show is for everybody. That's why Disney continues to be popular.
Mm-hmm.
So long and so consistently and around the world. It's for all audiences. And Walt was asked about that, and he said, we don't make shows for kids. If we did that, we'd be dead. Understood that probably better than anyone else. See, back in the 20s and 30s, in the early days of film, well, actually, the really early days of film are back, like, in, you know, the 1890s. But by our standards, it's still the early days of film. And no one thought about demographics, where, okay, this is for older men who like sports or whatever. They thought that they were making films that were for everybody. And Walt Disney was just really good at making films that work for everybody, including children.
I mean, I'm an adult and I have pretty much all of the early Disney movies and some of the later ones, like Beauty and the Beast. I was going to Belle and the Beast, Beauty and the Beast. And
I think you're thinking of Belle Book and Candle. But then
I love Belle Book and Candle. I love that.
But Beauty and the Beast, well, you know, that was what kind of revived Disney after the less active period following Walt's passing. Because he was such a hands-on producer, although he also let people have freedom. You know, that was, Walt was just great at finding the right person and then letting them do their thing.
I think the last two shows that he had his hands on before he died, and yet I think they finished it after he died. One was 101 Dalmatians and the other one was Bedknobs and Brooms.
Yes. And those are still good.
That's great. I love Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I love 101. I mean, I still will flip it in and watch it when I really need something to cheer me up.
Yeah, so, you know, all those rides that Walt worked on at the park, including Pirates of the Caribbean and Haunted Mansion and the Small, Small World, I mean, people around the world still love those because he had that knack for making something that would appeal to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the world has changed, and that's really just not what most producers and studios do. They're trying to do something for a particular audience. And only occasionally they're going to try and do what's called a four quadrant, where it appeals to all the demographics.
I was thinking about what you were saying, and you know what other production was for everybody, but my parents had to tell me that, was Looney Tunes. Because there was a level for little kids, and then there was a level for adults, and it was seamless that. But they were both there for both the parents and the children.
Sure, and you know, SpongeBob at the turn of the 21st century also did that very well, where the comedy worked for kids and it worked for teenagers and it worked for adults. And when that happens, it's really magical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you watch an old Bugs Bunny cartoon, which I still do from time to time because it was my favorite growing up. When I was a little kid, I laughed because he had Daffy Duck chasing himself. But later, when I was older and I understood what the cards were he was holding up, were that screwball and all these things, that's for the adults.
Yes. Well, when I see contemporary animation, I keep up with a lot of television because I like it, and also because I often enough asked to vote on awards for things in television, and I really want to know the whole field when I'm trying to evaluate who's doing a really good job. So I watch the shows and, you know, the ones that are for different age groups. I really try and appreciate them. And there are some shows even today that do that, but there is definitely you can feel the difference when the show is designed more for a particular age group and when it's a family show.
Yeah.
I appreciate the family shows. To me, that's really something special, and I know that people have to follow the brief. You know, if this is designed to appeal for little kids and that's the way they want to make it, then that's the way you do it. But if you can work on or experience something that's a family show, to me, that is often the things that I like the most, are the ones that appeal to everybody. And that's what we tried to do with Space Command.
Mm-hmm.
A series of epic adventures set in a hopeful future. and I wrote a theme song. Actually, it's really more the end title song, but it also has the main theme of the movie woven into it. And I collaborated on this song with my friend and a wonderful singer-songwriter named Marina V. And we wrote the lyrics and music together, again, weaving it around the main themes of the movie. And that's something that I really like, too, is having continuity, where you can start at the beginning and go to the end, and the whole thing makes sense, and it all kind of links up, and you feel like, okay, this is this whole world that I'm in, and I'm on a continuous journey. So the song is called World Unknown.
Okay.
I hope you enjoy it.
Okay, let's play it. World unknown, fate uncertain. The words we spoke can't be unspoken. It's really cinematic. Elegant, too. I love it.
Yes. A kind of a funny story about that, that the director of the film was not interested in having a song. So I kind of borrowed a page from my colleague James Horner, who passed away, but this is before that, and he was working with a director who did not want to have a song in his movie. But what he did to persuade the director was he wove the theme of the movie into the song. So it sounded like it was a continuation of the movie. And he got the best singer that he could possibly get to sing it. And the director changed his mind and allowed it to be in there. And he had a number one song and got an Academy Award. So we don't have a number one song and an Academy Award yet, but it's still a great song. And I'm so glad that it's in there, because I really think it kind of is a summation of the ideas and the spirit of the movie in a song.
I think that's really beautiful, though. I'm curious what movie it is, but I know you don't want to say.
Oh, you mean the one that Jamie Horner did?
Yeah.
Oh, it's Titanic.
Really?
Yep.
Oh my God! Is it the one I'm thinking of?
Strong-willed guy, and he made it clear that there were not going to be any songs in his movie.
Oh my God! And that's what everybody remembers.
Everybody remembers now.
Yeah. I can't remember. It's about the necklace. I can't remember the name of it. The heart.
My heart will go on.
That my heart will go on. It's one of the most beautiful songs, too.
Yes. And
I didn't know that James Cameron didn't want that.
He didn't want it until it was actually done and he could see or hear it. And then he wanted it.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine Titanic without
it? Into the movie, and I wove the song into the movie without anybody knowing that that's what I was doing. And if they had known that I was doing that, they would have stopped me.
Yeah.
Because that's the way they were. Just like the Cameron was. So,
I just can't imagine Titanic without it.
Yep. Well, that's because Horner understood that music, and particularly a song, could elevate the whole movie. And he planned it out so that could happen. But the other people working on it may not have been able to see that potential, but that was there. The music could help elevate the film even farther. But he literally had to wait until that whole long, you know, like 2-year process was done before he could show the song. And he had to get Celine Dion to sing it and all that. But when all those things were lined up, it clicked and it helped the film. And Cameron, to his credit, was able to change his mind.
Just amazing. So you did what he did. You did what James Horner did.
On a smaller scale.
That's cool. Do you have anything coming up, or did I miss anything that you want to talk about?
Give me just a second. Yes. I also do concert music, live music, that sometimes is for full orchestra and sometimes a song. And while I was president of the local composers group, we were putting on a holiday concert, which we often do, and I wrote a song of the season I had always loved the poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since I was a kid, I thought that it would be a great lyric for a song. I mean, the poetry itself has music in it, and I wanted to enhance that and bring that out and make it more specific. But the Frost Estate was adamant that adaptations were not okay, ever. And they made like a couple of exceptions over decades, and they weren't happy with the way those came out. So it was just no. And some very famous people, artists that, you know, sell millions and all that, had tried to adapt, thinking that, well, you know, come on, it's me. They're going to say yes to me. Nope, you can't do it. But it finally went into the public domain, Stopping by Woods. So this is my setting of Stopping by Woods. Do you remember the poem?
I do, but I don't remember it by heart.
I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He won't see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow.
It's a beautiful poem. It probably is a beautiful lyric.
Yes. Well, you can hear it.
Okay.
Glad you like it.
The performers
are Julia Huang's soprano and Brian Pizzoni piano.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes, Brian plays on all kinds of things, from hit albums to major movie soundtracks. Like he played on the latest Star Wars trilogy, so you know, very big films.
Yeah, that's a big. That's like one of the biggest films.
Yes, but he likes also playing the more intimate live music like this. And there's actually a funny story about that, if you want a funny story.
Yeah, of course.
This was the first performance, and I'm hoping to record it when I can get the budget together to, you know, hire the studio and do everything, quote, properly for recording. But this was a live performance in front of an audience. And everything was written out. I love improvising, and I do it all the time, but for something like this, you really have to have the music written out so everything matches up, because, you know, the poem is so beautiful and it's so carefully constructed, you want everything to really match up and you know, do justice to it. And while the performance was going on, the music fell off the stand. And I don't think anybody could tell if I didn't mention it. And I don't want to put them on the spot or embarrass them, because I think they did an amazing job. You can't tell that anything was wrong, but that actually happened. That somehow their state of meditation and focus on the music was so perfect that even when something went wrong, they could just go with the flow and make it right again.
Wow. But was there like you could hear the papers and like a bang or something when it fell?
somehow I can't hear that. And, you know, maybe if we went in with like AI software that can extract out certain sound, we might be able to get to things like the rustling of the page or whatever. But I'm usually not into doing musical forensics like that. I just like to accept it the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm listening closely, I'm listening for, wow, I want to really focus in on that beautiful part. I don't want to try and find flaws.
Oh, yeah, of course. I don't know. It's just like I watch BookTube, and every once in a while they will do what they call like a bookshelf tour. And they would be showing the different books and pulling them out so they can see the cover and what book it is and stuff. And every once in a while, the book falls. And you hear kerplop.
Kerplop.
And, I mean, these aren't hardcovers. These are paperbacks, and you can still hear kerplop when it falls. So
yes.
That's why I was curious.
Well, it just came out pretty well, and I'm hoping to record it properly, where we can do justice to everything and get the beautiful sonics that you can get from a good studio with a good engineer.
Cool.
And let's see. Currently, what I'm working on, I just finished a comedy about, it's a fish out of water story called Waking Up in Idaho that I did with bluegrass music about foster kids who end up in Idaho, in rural areas. So that's fun. And also I'm working on, creating a meditation album. And I'm thinking of calling it Tesseract. And if you're kind of familiar with a Tesseract, it's a four-dimensional object. And so this is sort of meditating on the fourth dimension and going beyond 3D into 4D and expanding your consciousness while you're meditating.
That's interesting. I've done meditations, and I've never done that. I've done, you know, the sound meditations with the bowl and the ball and the sound coming from it, but I've never meditated on a four-dimensional object. That must be interesting. Have you done it?
Have you
meditated
meditation music before? And yes, we are using the same bowl.
Oh, so the same bowl. Okay.
Yes, I'm using the singing bowls, and I'm using bamboo flute, and we're using harp and cello, and other interesting meditation type things like gongs.
Yeah, is the gong to tell you when you'd be coming out? Because that's what the usual thing is. That you should be pulling out of the meditation.
Well, I'm using the gong, and I'm transforming the sound to help draw you into the meditation.
Oh, okay. That's different. That's cool. And when will that be available?
Well, hopefully soon. A lot of this is just getting together the resources to do it. I'm a big collaborator, and I love working with people and love working with musicians and other artists. And I think I'm at my best when I'm collaborating and hopefully bring out the best in others. So that's where that's at.
Okay.
Okay,
we're coming to the end. Could you give your website so when stuff is coming out, they can find it, and also your social media so they can say hi?
Well, I'm David Raiklen, DavidRaiklen, and you can find me on YouTube or on SoundCloud. SoundCloud, I'm Cinematic1, which is actually my email. And under my name on Instagram and on Facebook. So friend me, follow me, and you'll get all kinds of entertainment for free.
Cool. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to chat with me. I've so enjoyed it. I love your music. I think you're incredible.
Thank you. It's a joy to be on your show. You're a wonderful host, and I hope that you have a beautiful day.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.